Today on The Journey with Steve DeWitt.
Your greatest enemy is forgetfulness. You see, it's one thing to get through the river, but that's not the end of it all. You got to remember what happened there. And what we find here is that God knew this, God realized this, and He commanded that there be a permanent reminder to the people of God regarding what He had done for them.
Do you ever forget the big moments of God's faithfulness in your life? Today on The Journey with Pastor Steve DeWitt, we dive into Joshua chapter 4 to discover God's heart for remembrance. We're naturally forgetful, but God wants us to intentionally recall His power, provisions, and faithfulness. Remembering fuels our faith for what's ahead and helps us trust God in the unknown. Pastor Steve shares, why spiritual memory matters for all believers. It's a powerful reminder to remember and celebrate God's work in your life. Now here's Pastor Steve DeWitt with today's message.
If it's easy to forget the little things, is it also easy to forget the big things? If it's easy to forget the big things, is God interested in us remembering? And does He do anything for us to help us to remember? That's what we're going to talk about this morning, is what does God do for His people to help them? Well, if you're not there yet, you ought to be. Joshua chapter 4, we're in the midst of a verse-by-verse exposition of the book of Joshua. And last week, we studied Joshua chapter 3, the saga, the story of one of God's mighty redemptive acts for His people in which He brought them into the promised land. They crossed the Jordan River. Chapter 4 is basically a retelling of the story, only including a few specific details that you didn't get in chapter 3. And you may say, man, what is the big deal about this whole crossing thing? I mean, why are we talking about it two Sundays in a row? Well, what we find is that in God's Word, He devoted two chapters to the crossing. And so if it's important to God, we'll make it important to us, and we'll study it for 2 weeks in a row. Joshua chapter 4. We find that in the first 7 verses of chapter 4, God and Joshua give some specific commands. Let's begin then reading verse 1. When the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, "Choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priest stood, and to carry them over with you and put them down at the place where you stay tonight." Now, if you were here last week, you should have all of a sudden, as I read that, gone, wait a second, I've heard about that before. And instantly in your mind thought, verse 12 of chapter 3, where we find these 12 guys first mentioned. Now then, choose 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one from each tribe. And then in chapter 3, it just kind of goes on. It leaves us hanging there. It's like, well, what are these guys going to do? Well, here in chapter 4, it picks up the story as we find that they're to go and to take these stones. Now, one thing I want to say, because I want you to understand what the writer of Joshua is trying to get across. One thing realized, when biblical writers write, they don't necessarily think chronologically. That's one reason when you study the Gospels, for example, there are seeming discrepancies in the chronology of what happened in Jesus' life. It's because those writers were painting a portrait, and they used the stories, much like a painter would use his brush and his colors, to paint a picture. Same thing that we find here in chapter 4 of Joshua, where either they went all the way across the Jordan River, and then Joshua gives them this command again, choose 12 men from amongst the tribes of Israel, or the writer of Joshua simply inserted this where it was appropriate to the story. And I think that's probably what happened. So the command goes out now to go to where the ark stood and to take a stone. Look at verse 4. So Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and said to them, "Go over before the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, to serve as a sign among you." Now, what we find is there is a command to go where the priests are standing with the ark. And the size of this stone, by the way, is indicated by the fact that they're supposed to put it where as they carry it? On their shoulder. So that Joshua's not saying, go get some skipping stones that we can then have a little contest when we get back and have the Jordan River flowing. He's saying, I want something big. And if you know male egos and the fact that the tribes were on the other side going, go, 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 get the stone, no doubt the guys were there trying to get the very biggest stone that they could so that the tribe of Reuben could say, our stone's bigger than the tribe of Gad or something. So it's probably big stones. It's not really key to the story. I just throw that out for your benefit there. Big stones that they're carrying back. Now, what was the purpose of these stones? Look at what verse 6 says. They are to serve as a sign. We're beginning to understand what God has in mind with these stones. They're to serve as a sign for something. Now, the raising of stones and the building of stone monuments was a common thing in the ancient world. They would put these stones up like Stonehenge. If you've heard of Stonehenge in England, they've got these big stones. To this day, we don't know what they're there for, but you know what? It meant something to them. There was something that they were saying with those stones. Much like we do today. We send somebody to the moon. What's the first thing we want them to do? Put that flag out there from the United States to show that what? We were there, weren't we? And we beat those Russians to the moon. That's why we got our flag up there. Or we send somebody to the North Pole. What do we want them to do? Put a flag right there in the North Pole saying we were here. And we were here first. That's what these stones apparently are beginning to understand what they were doing. Now, one example of raising of stones that ought to be particularly interesting to this church, by the way, was one that we find with Jacob. Jacob is in the midst of one of these back and forth between Laban and his mom and dad's house. And he lays down to sleep. And while he's sleeping, he puts his head on a stone. And as he's sleeping, he has this vision. And this vision is of a ladder. A stairway to heaven, going to heaven, and up and down the ladder are going angels. And Jacob wakes up, and look at what he does. It says, when Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was not aware of it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. Early the next morning, Jacob took the stone he had placed under his head and set it up as a pillar, a monument, and poured oil on top of it. He called that place Bethel. Did you know the name of our church comes from one of these stone-raising ceremonies? Okay, apparently you all did. You're like, we knew that, Steve. We've heard that lots of times. So I thought, wow, they're not going to know that. This is a stone-raising church, if you will. So anyway, that's just food for thought. The point is that raising of stones served as a sign. It did for Bethel. By the way, it's interesting. The verse goes on to say it used to be called Luz, and aren't we glad we didn't name the church that here? All right. Now, there is a specific purpose that he has in mind here, though. Look at verse 6. Joshua says, when your children ask, what are these stones for? So apparently, these stones were designed to arouse the curiosity of people and make them ask, what are these stones doing here? And if you have spent any time with children, you know this is not a problem with children, right? What do they do all the time? They ask, Daddy, what's that? Daddy, what's this? Mommy, what's that doing there? Why is this that way? And you're like, stop asking questions. At times, it can get annoying, but they're curious. They want to know. And so the parents were to use this natural curiosity and these stones, and I did this first service, and I don't mean to offend whoever's put this flower arrangement together, it's just an illustration of a pile here of stones. These pile of stones are to be used as a teaching moment for the families as they teach their kids. Now, I have to highlight again the fact that we talked about last week. Why did the ark go into the Jordan first? Why did God say, I want my presence going first? So that when everybody saw what happened, who got the credit? God did. And that God is in the business of bringing glory to himself. We find that here also, again, verse 7. He says it again, the water was cut off before the ark. Not before the Israelites, but before the ark. So that God gets the credit. So these stones then are a sign, they're a memorial, as it says in verse 7, to the people of Israel forever regarding what God had done. Now, let's move on to the next section. We find a familiar pattern. God tells Joshua something to do. Joshua tells the people what to do. The people obey. So the Israelites did as Joshua commanded them. They took 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, as the Lord had told Joshua. And they carried them over with them to their camp, where they put them down. Joshua set up the 12 stones that had been in the middle of the Jordan at the spot where the priests who had carried the Ark of the Covenant had stood, and they are there to this day. Now, here's where you got to pay attention. This is important. It's a little bit complicated. We don't find that there is one pile of stones. There are two piles of stones. The first pile we find here in verse 8 is the pile that the guys gathered from the middle, carried to the camp, and we don't know what's going to happen with them yet. We'll get to that in a second. The second pile, though, is here in verse 9, where Joshua sets up 12 stones that had been in the middle of the Jordan at the spot where the priests were holding the ark. So the water is still backed up. The people of Israel have crossed the Jordan River. Joshua now goes back to where those priests are holding this heavy Ark of the Covenant, and he gathers 12 stones and makes a big pile right there in the middle of the Jordan River. Pile number one. Interesting. Again, almost like the flag, right? What's it saying? We were right here. That's the only way you can explain this pile of stones right here, is that we were right here. Now, verse 10, let's continue on. Now the priests who had carried the ark remained standing in the middle of the Jordan until everything the Lord had commanded Joshua was done by the people, just as Moses had directed Joshua. The people hurried over, and as soon as all of them had crossed, the ark of the Lord and the priests came to the other side while the people watched. So all the people had come across. They were standing in the middle. Now they moved to the edge of the Jordan River. They're still in. Notice what happens next. The men of Manasseh crossed over armed in front of the Israelites as Moses had directed them. About 40,000 armed for battle crossed over before the Lord to the plains of Jericho for war. Now, if you weren't here this first Sunday night we began this series, and you have no idea what's going on, which, by the way, is just a real good reason to come on Sunday nights, is so that when things like this happen, you go, I know what he's talking about. But very short, let me tell you what happened. Back in chapter 1, we find that there were 2.5 tribes of Israel that back when Moses was leading this wandering time in the wilderness, they said, we don't want to have land west of the Jordan River. We want to have land east of the Jordan River. Moses said, we'll give you that land if you promise that your men will go in and fight for their brothers. And once their brothers' land has been conquered, then they can go back to the other side and build their cities. And so they agreed. They said, we'll do that. And that's what we find here, is that these guys are fulfilling what they said that they would do. The men of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, they cross over. It says, armed for battle. Now, why would they be armed for battle? Remember, you've got just a few miles away from all of this, one of the most notorious military fortresses in antiquity. And they crossed over ready to fight off anybody who might want to attack the Israelites as they cross the Jordan River. So there they are, armed for battle, they're ready to go. Verse 14, we find, that day the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they revered him all the days of his life, just as they had revered Moses. God fulfilled what he said he would do in chapter 3, and he exalted Joshua in their sight. And last Sunday night, keep going back to these Sunday nights, but last Sunday night we talked about the fact that God exalts the man, not the man. That's so easy for us men to try to exalt ourselves, make ourselves look good, try to have people say, wow, he's really somebody. But in reality, it's God that exalts the man, not the man. We studied that last Sunday night, and here God fulfills what he said. They revered Joshua all the days of his life. Now, let's move on in the story to Jordan's return. Look at verse 15. It says this, then the Lord said to Joshua, command the priests carrying the Ark of the Testimony to come up out of the Jordan. So Joshua commanded the priests, come up out of the Jordan. Again, we find that little God to leadership, leadership to people, people obedience going on. And the priests came up out of the river carrying the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. No sooner had they set their feet on dry ground than the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and ran at flood stage as before. Now, last week we talked about the fact that what probably took place, that this Jordan River was not like a gradual where they kind of slowly went in. Where they went in at it was one big step. And when they stepped in, they were in. And so this was a step of faith for them as they carried the Ark of the Covenant. But as they stepped in, excuse me one second, here in the front row, as they stepped in, what happened was, 20 miles upstream, that thing backs up in a heap like that. The moment now, they come to the other side, let's say I'm on the other side right now, they step out, the moment their feet came out of the water, whoosh, down comes this river flowing, again at flood stage. Now some people try to say, well, we can explain why that happened. And they have historical accounts of how there were mudslides upstream, and the Jordan River has backed up at different times, which of course is ludicrous because what are the chances of the water happening to back up the moment they step in and happening to come back the moment they step out? This can only be what? The hand of God. And that's the point. God's giving himself credit for what he did. It's unmistakable that he was the one that did this. Now, given the fact that we are here in Chicago and the Chicagoland area, I couldn't help but just have a little moment of fun and frivolity on this interesting point of Jordan's return and draw a few parallels that we find quite interesting to the Jordan's return and MJ's return just a year or two ago. Number one, we find that in both cases, a whole nation was watching. Number two, we find that there were definitely bulls involved. Number three is it was kind of cold at first. Number four, once it got going, everything in its path was swept into the Dead Sea. And finally, perhaps most important, it'll be there next year. So anyway, all $36 million of it will be there next year. Jordan's return. Okay, let's move on to the story. To where Joshua now sums up all that has been going on, and he gives, as all great men of God do, a sermon. He gives a sermon here, beginning in verse 19. Look at what it says. On the 10th day of the first month, the people went up from the Jordan and camped at Gilgal on the eastern border of Jericho. Now, Gilgal was strategically located for the Israelites. Behind them, they have the Jordan River. Is anybody going to attack them from behind? No, no. In front of them are the plains of Jericho, which means they can see a long ways, so there's no surprise attack. It's a good place for them to go. Now, I don't think anybody really perked their ears up as I was reading, and I said the 10th day of the first month. Anybody sort of go, oh. I didn't hear any of those go on out there. That's because you're not a Jewish audience, and we're going to keep coming back to that because you got to read the Bible through Jewish eyes. But if you were a Jewish audience, you'd go, the 10th day of the first month, much like if somebody and you were over in Europe or something and they said the 4th of July, instantly you think Independence Day, right? Declaration of Independence. For Israel, the 10th day of the first month was that. That was the day they came up out of Egypt, the very day. And what we find here so interesting is the day they come into the Promised Land is the 10th day of the first month. Does the Lord have timing? Oh yeah, big time. There's a principle here too is you do what God's told you to do and God will take care of the timing, whatever the issue is in your life. He did it here for Israel. 40 years to the day they came back up out of the Jordan River. Now look at what Joshua does, verse 20. And Joshua set up at Gilgal the 12 stones they had taken out of the Jordan. Again, two piles of stones. They've been carrying this 12 stones now from the middle of the Jordan River to the edge of the Jordan River to camp next to the Jordan River, and now they take it to Gilgal. So those 12 guys are ready to get rid of these stones by now. They're big, they're heavy, but Joshua takes them and he sets them up. Now we don't know how he set them up. Stonehenge, for example, is in a circle, right? It might have been in a circle. It might have been a pile. I think it's probably a pile, especially in the Jericho or in the Jordan River, so that it would be visible. We don't know how he did it, but he sets these stones up. And now he moves on to his message. Look what he says now, beginning in verse 21. He said to the Israelites, in the future, when your descendants ask their fathers, what do these stones mean? Tell them, Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground, for the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed over. The Lord your God did to the Jordan just what he had done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us until we had crossed over. He did this so that all peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful and so that you might always fear the Lord your God. And that ends chapter 4. But what we find is that Joshua explains what this whole pile thing is all about. Why the pile of stones? The first thing he says is that this pile of stones is to be used to instruct future generations about who God is and what he did for us. We don't want to forget this. We want our kids to remember it. We want their kids to remember it. We don't want them to forget. The second thing he says, the second reason for this pile of stones, it's not just for the Israelites, but it's for all nations and all peoples that all men may know two things, that the Lord is powerful and that they must know him and that they must fear him. That's why he did it. That's what that pile of stones was all about. Now, this echoes last week, doesn't it? Remember again, going back to why did the ark go in first? It went in first so that God would get the credit for what went on. Now God is ensuring the fact that he will always get the credit for what went on at the Jordan River. And he says, this will be an enduring legacy for what I did for the people of God. And that this knowledge of God would lead to a fear of the Lord, it says in verse 24, which is the most fundamental expression of faith in the Old Testament. Like Proverbs 1, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but fools despise discipline. It's not a slavish dread of God, but rather it contains an element of recognizing God's glory and then responding in praise and trust. So that these stones then, this pile of stones right here, these stones were to symbolize what God had done. They're like a broken record right here. You know, when your record's skipping and you're saying that same thing over and over again, these stones are saying this: there's a God. He is powerful. He backed up the Jordan River for his people. You must fear him. There is a God. He is powerful. And those stones would be a lasting legacy, speaking out that to everyone that saw it. So Joshua 4 basically concludes with this message from Joshua. It leaves the people of God now on the west side of the Jordan River. It ends the narrative regarding one of the most miraculous things God ever did for his people. Israel's about ready to make war with Jericho. We've got two piles of stones, one in the Jordan River and one at Gilgal. And that's chapter 4. Now, we need to move to application. What does God want us to know and to realize from this passage? If I was to ask you this morning, and I really could go person to person here down the rows, if I was to ask you, what is the greatest danger to your spiritual walk this morning, what would you say? What is the biggest enemy that you are facing in your walk with the Lord? What would you say? Now, some of you would say, well, it's false teaching. It's false teaching, brother. We got to keep those false teachers out of here. And you know what? It's true. That's not the greatest danger. You may say, well, it's satanic attacks. Satan's attacking me right now. That's the greatest danger. And you know what? That's something not to be messed with either. But it's not the greatest enemy that you face this morning. You want to know what the greatest enemy that you face this morning in your walk with the Lord? It's this. Your greatest enemy is forgetfulness.
Thank you for joining us here on The Journey with Pastor Steve DeWitt. Today on The Journey, we looked at Joshua chapter 4, where God's people finally crossed the Jordan River into the Promised Land. But before moving forward, God tells them to pause and remember. God knows how forgetful we can be. In the rush of life, we move on quickly from His miracles and provision. But remembering His faithfulness fuels our faith and the faith of others. It reminds us of who God is and what He's done, and why we can trust Him moving forward. So what does it look like to pass on stories of God's power to the next generation? I hope you can quickly recall some moments of God's faithfulness that deserve to be remembered and retold. As Pastor Steve reminds us, God's people are remembering people. Here at The Journey, we're passionate about pointing listeners to the truth of the gospel through Bible-based teaching and resources. We desire to reach listeners with stories of our mighty and faithful God. Would you prayerfully consider partnering with us today by giving a financial gift? You can give anytime on our website by visiting thejourney.fm or by calling us at 844-7-JOURNEY. Again, that's 844-756-8763. And we also want to invite you to join us for worship this weekend at Bethel Church in Crown Point, Indiana, or any of our surrounding campuses. Find service times, directions, and more at bethelweb.org. Well, I'm Tim Svoboda. Thank you for joining us today on The Journey. Be sure to join us tomorrow as we continue our Joshua series and the second half of Pastor Steve's message titled, That the World May Know. That's Thursday on The Journey. Today's program was produced and furnished by Bethel Church in Crown Point, Indiana.